to. So, I mean, in the end, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He knows where this is all heading to, right? We do believe with firm belief that this is heading towards good, right? I can comfortably say that. I can easily say that, confidently say that. This is all going towards good. And this is one of the things that people need to realize, is that despite, you know, sometimes things seem to be not going in our way, but if we work hard, if we try hard, you know, if we think, we calculate, we plan, we have good leaders, we have good friends, we have good brothers, you know, and we have the help of Allah with us, you know, then good things will come. And inshallah, this is what I believe. I believe that good things will come. What exactly, in what speed, how fast, you know, I won't be able to comment on that specifically.
The Holy Quran says, وَمَكَرُوا وَمَكَرَ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ.
Ahsan.
You know, they plan and we plan, and Allah is the best of planners. So we can see that this is part of the grand scheme of, this is part of the enemy's plan, but it falls within the kind of folds of Allah's grand plan. And we can almost see it taking shape now. It's almost, it can give you shivers.
Yeah, let me just, because actually two or three things came to my mind. I'm just going to list and then I'll hand it over to Sheikh Ali. One that definitely, based upon the analysis that can be witnessed in today's time, right? The American government is headed for some serious trouble. They're not going to be able to sustain themselves, neither economically nor morally, within domestically nor internationally. They are losing the battle on all of these fronts, right? Domestically and internationally, morally, economically, militarily. I mean, you name it. We are witnessing a dramatic paradigm shift. China is much more stronger than the United States. Russia is much more stronger than the United States. And probably one of the players on the global arena which is not paid attention to, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, is also much stronger than the United States. This on one side. Two, the Zionist regime is also headed for trouble. They cannot, and this is for people need to go and research, economically, they cannot sustain themselves. Economically, they're heading for trouble. You can see poverty and joblessness and unemployment. And economically, it's breaking from
protests
inside.
Protests are taking place over there.
Right? Israel, right? The corruption within the government. The government is also going to fall apart. And militarily, we have seen inconsistent conflicts with either Hamas in the Gaza Strip or Hezbollah in Lebanon, that the Israeli military has not been able to fight these guys off. So militarily, they're also going to lose. And the third point, which is my last one, is that the Islamic Republic of Iran is going to continue to become stronger day by day, and they will continue to gain more friends in the region and internationally. And then from then on, we leave it to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
It's kind of difficult to predict the future, right? But some things that we can see, and as Sayyid has mentioned, and I think very eloquently and properly and precisely, we do see these things happening. I think if you look at a macro level, there is going to be more polarization, so to speak. The camp of arrogance is going to be on one side, and the camp of the oppressors and justice seekers are going to be on the other side. Mm-hmm. This polarization is going to continue to increase, and we have seen an incline and increase in this polarization last decade,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is going to continue to happen for sure. The camp of the oppressed is going to keep getting stronger and stronger, while you see that the camp of the oppressors is going to have fewer and limited friends. People are waking up to the reality that it's only a select few, that 1% that is ruling, and the rest are being ruled, and they're being abused, not just being ruled. So this reality is going to become more evident in inshallah near future, and as we proceed, it's going to grow. In terms of, you know, the oppressed camp coming into power, see, we do believe as part of our faith that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has destined that this world is going to be ruled by the oppressed. This is something set in stone, right? This is something that is going to happen. When is a question of how well we perform,
right?
You know, ونريد أن نمن على الذين استضعفوا في الأرض ونجعلهم أئمة ونجعلهم الوارثين. Right? So it is bound to happen. How well we perform the responsibilities on our shoulders, right? The general masses and the preachers and the academics and the students and, you know, anyone, the men, the women, you know. If we perform well, seems like things are actually pretty fast-paced at the moment. Just look at this 2020. You know, everybody feels that, you know, just compare it with 2019.
Yeah, just right? 2019.
All of the listeners that are listening to us and ourselves, we were present in 2019. Compare it with 2020. You feel that your life has been just
weird.
Like a roller coaster, right?
It's
like,
Sheikh, you're giving me a headache just trying to make me think about it.
Right? So things are pacing up.
Yeah, this
and
year
they're
has been
rapidly
weird.
Pacing up. And we're feeling it. All of us are feeling it individually and then collectively. We sit down, we talk, and we have the same feeling. So it's not something, you know, that's a very exceptional case that, oh, just your life is a turmoil, is in turmoil right now. No, it's the entire world. So I see that, you know, the Zionist regime is on its way to where it should be, which is non-existence. And the camp led by the United States of America, I think it's going to lose its grip. It has actually already lost its grip, but I don't want to open up this whole can of worms to prove. It's very easy to prove, by the
way.
You look at, yeah, you look at Iraq, you look at Afghanistan, you look at Syria. I'm just giving you pointers. You look at Yemen, you look at Lebanon, right? All of the Muslim lands. Now, you know, the protests in France and,
look
you know.
Look at Black Lives Matter, destroying them from
within
inside.
Within the United States of America, it's unprecedented what's happening. People are out on streets with their guns. And those are not small little pistols. They're like proper AK-47s and I don't know what, like
automatic,
the rifles and automatic weaponry, right?
Yeah.
So we already see that the United States of America has lost its grip.
Yeah,
not only on this region, the West Asia, but even in the Western countries. Even when you look at it academically and in terms of their ideology prevailing, I think enough people have woken up to the reality that this democracy and the liberal democracy, it was nothing but a hoax.
Yeah.
So for last 200 years, they built up something to fool the masses. And now they're waking up to that reality. Everybody know what's the reality of... Not everybody, but a good chunk of people know what the reality of freedom is, what the reality of freedom of selection is, what the reality of people who come into power is, you know, how they're selected rather than elected, right? So I think it's getting very clear. The masses, one thing, you know, I want to bring up before I conclude my thought is the leadership of the world. When we talked about, in the beginning of this point, two camps, right? Inevitably, both of the camps have to be led by someone. You can't just have a camp without a leader, right? Now, this camp of the oppressed, it is and it will be even more openly led by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Why? Because it has the solution for the world.
Yeah.
Why? Because it believes in Islam and has practiced Islam. Yes, it's going through its own challenges. Some of them are inevitable because we are all humans. We make mistakes. And the others are imposed challenges, right? Through economy, for instance, one of the challenges right now at hand is economy. But if you look at the future and those who have a good ability to analyze, they can see that Islam and Iran is on the rise, right? Technologically, scientifically, academically, you know, this is what the future is. Inshallah, if it turns out that way, we're hopeful and await this time that the world will be a better place to live, especially if this camp gets stronger, it triggers the reappearance of the Imam of the time.
Yeah, you mean.
Right, because the Imam... is going to lead people. If people are not ready for the infallible Imam, then who is he going to come and lead? Right? One of the reasons why he's in occultation, one of the probable reasons. So, you know, he reappears, the world is going to be not just a better place, rather a different place to live in.
Yes.
Right? Something that it was supposed to be from day one.
Subhanallah.
Right? So that's where we are headed. That's where That's how I look at future, and this is where our hopes and prayers lie.
Any closing statements, Sayyid Mehdi?
No, I think that was a great closing statement by Sheikh Ali.
Now, there might be some voices out there who think that they won't be able to make a difference, or they won't be able to contribute to this great global mission. No, yes, you will. Every voice counts. Every person's action counts. And it doesn't matter where you are, wherever you are, you have the ability to make a difference. And don't ever, ever, ever let your seemingly small numbers deceive you. The Quran says, إِنَّمَا أَعِذُكُمْ بِوَاحِدَ أَن تَقُومُوا لِلَّهِ مَثْنَا وَفُرَادَ. I only urge you to one thing, and that is that you rise for the sake of Allah in your pairs, or if you're on your own as well. From myself, from Sayyid Mehdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com. And you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah, Allah.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a problem and a question that is very important, and that is the problem of God's being the creator of all things. This is a basic belief of the Islamic faith, of all faiths, the idea that God is the creator of all things. At the same time, we know that we have been made religiously responsible to perform certain actions, and if we don't perform them, we will be punished. If we do perform them, we will be rewarded. Indirectly, this implies that we are the agents that perform these actions. Otherwise, if God was the immediate agent that performed them, and His rewarding us for our actions or punishing Him for them would be an act of oppression, which is unbecoming of God. So, we have to simultaneously affirm God's attribute of being the ultimate cause of all things with the idea that we are the immediate agents of certain effects. A question that arises here is the following. That certain actions that we perform or certain actions that stem from certain agents or certain effects that stem from certain agents are considered by us to be evil, or they're considered by us to be ugly and unbecoming of a being such as God. How can we ascribe these actions which are evil to God, who is a being who is purely good? And how could we ascribe these actions which are unbecoming or ugly to a being who is sheer beauty and who is wise? And these two seem to be irreconcilable with one another. In other words, there's two questions here. The first question or objection to God's being the creator of all things is this idea or the intuitive belief that we are the agents of certain actions which stem from us. This dimension of this question is not specifically related to those actions which are good or bad. It includes both of them. The answer to this question is that we are the immediate agents of these acts. However, God is the ultimate and final cause of them, and there is no contradiction between them. Another dimension to this problem is this, that specifically certain actions are evil, other actions are ugly, and therefore they cannot stem from an agent which is pure good and pure beauty and pure knowledge and wisdom. So therefore we have to accept, make an exception to God's agency and say that there are certain things which he doesn't create. So there's two dimensions. This second dimension of this problem is specifically related to certain acts, those acts which are unbecoming and ugly and those acts which are evil. So this is something which should be independently investigated. It's a problem which is different from the first. We can talk about each one of these separately. Today we'll talk about the problem of evil very briefly. This is a problem which is very historically, it's been discussed from times immemorial. One of the answers which has been given to this question is the following, that we don't actually believe that God is the creator of all things. Rather, God is the creator of the good things and the beauty in this world, and there's another creator in this world alongside God who is the creator of evil and the ugly actions that exist in this world. This is an answer which we believe is unacceptable. In essence, this is shirk and polytheism. It's dualism, and of course it's been ascribed to certain faiths, such as, apparently it's been ascribed to Zoroastrianism. We have to address this question in some of our forthcoming, address this idea in some of our forthcoming sessions. Until then, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful Salaamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing Here on IRIB English Radio Thank you for joining with us and I'm your host Hasnain And we have our guest speaker with us, Brother Miqdad He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi Aqum. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad, so one of our listeners has sent us their question. Let me read it for you. It says that, My child is three and alhamdulillah, she has many toys at home. However, she is very possessive about her toys. And whenever we have other kids at home, it's constant fight and battle. Because she just doesn't want to share. I have now stopped calling her friends home. I'm not sure how healthy that is. What can I do? So Brother Miqdad, this is another problem faced by our parents. So we usually get to see that children don't like to share their toys with others. What do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is a natural phase that perhaps happens in many cases, in many children. It's part of their growth. It's part of the natural phases that children go through.
Yeah.
That it comes a point where they realize that they own something and they feel possessive about that. And they feel that this is mine and it's not yours and you can't have it. There's a couple of things I'd like to mention before I go on to a couple of suggestions regarding this. It's important to make sure that we give the child the space to explore this possession,
okay.
Right? It comes back to something we talked about in the previous show as well about this feeling of safety,
yeah.
Right? Children need that their parents give them support and make them feel safe about what they own.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why children become possessive is because they feel that it might be taken away from them,
oh.
Right? So I don't want to share because if I give it to you, then you'll just take it from me, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not a rational feeling. It's not a rational thing, but children don't have the capacity to explore or to think it irrationally right, like this. The key is that for parents to really give them the support.
Yeah.
So the worst thing that parents can do over here is to snatch the toy from their child and give it to the other child.
Yeah.
This actually creates a mistrust, a lack of trust, and actually a feeling of an anger, basically, that not only I was insecure by my possession, but now even more insecure because my parents are on against me, basically.
Yeah.
They're removing this feeling of safety that I wanted to build in regards to the possessions that I have. So the first point is that parents should make the child feel really safe about their possession, that what you possess, don't worry, it won't be taken away from you.
Yeah, it remains with you.
It remains with you. Now, this goes even a long way in terms of even the relationships as well. Parents,
yeah.
you know when a child is very young, a baby, a couple of months old, baby, even under the age of 1.5, they should always feel that even their parents are like that as well.
Yeah.
They should never feel insecure about their parents' presence. So this is why we often say that parents should always be available for their baby, especially the mom.
Yeah.
Especially the mom. Mom should always be available for the baby before the age of 1.5.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be ever the case that the baby feel that I've lost my mom or I don't have access to my mom because they feel what creates from this is a fear that I can lose my mom. I can lose what I own,
yeah.
Basically. And this fear is not healthy for growth.
Yeah.
On the contrary, what we should give to our children is a feeling of safety.
Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, and your listeners, stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys, one is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5, and they constantly fight and wrestle with each other and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry, we're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program of Islamic Upbringing, IRIB English Radio. So we're talking with Brother Mehdad. Let's continue.
So the first point was to create a very strong level of safety and security for a child regarding the relationship with their parents, as well as, or ultimately, or consequently after that as well, the a safety in relation to the possessions that they have, the toys that they have. So to make them feel that, you know what, these toys are yours and they won't be taken away from you.
No.
Now, one way obviously is to, from a parent's perspective, to do this, and through words and also through their reactions as well, that whenever they don't want to share, we don't force them to share.
Yeah.
Yes, you can encourage a child to share. You can say, if you share,
you can just ensure
thing.
The child that, you know, the won't be taken away. The toys won't be taken away.
Exactly. You can tell that the child, for example, you can share your toys and the toys, she'll, the other person, your friend, for example, will give you back the toy in 5 minutes,
yeah.
For example, in 10 minutes. So the child feels safe. However, at the beginning, this might be difficult because the child doesn't understand that,
yeah.
And can't really trust or believe in that,
mm-hmm.
At the beginning. It requires a lot of trust that they have with their parents from the beginning, that this emotional need has been satisfied throughout childhood, that they've always felt safety and trust with their parents. But again, as I said, it's a natural process. It will be overcome slowly, slowly. And another way to do this as well is for them to actually witness this. So sometimes it takes time.
Yeah.
Just through time, if they have a toy and they've seen this toy with them for weeks and perhaps even months sometimes, then now they actually can believe it because they've seen it happen, right? So as we say, it's a phase. It'll just pass.
Yeah.
Phase takes a few months to pass.
It'll pass over.
And it'll pass as well naturally because they realize that, hold on a second, these toys that I was fighting for, they're still with me. Nothing has happened, basically.
Uh-huh.
So they themselves realize that, no, it's okay. The other thing is that through experience as well, that they learn that toys and what I own basically does come back to me.
Yeah.
So one of the ways to do this is to encourage children to go to other people's friends as well. So I know in the question, the parent is saying that I've stopped calling friends home. Perhaps in a short-term solution, that might be plausible and a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But don't stop going to other people's houses.
Uh-huh.
So for some time, rather than inviting friends at home, then go to their houses, basically.
Yeah.
And when you're there, the child actually interacts with their friends, and they share toys or they play together with toys.
Yeah.
And then what happens, obviously, the children, through seeing this, through seeing that we're playing together, toys that don't belong to me, but at the end of the day, when I went home, those toys remained with my friend, basically. They were her or his toys, basically. So they actually, through experience, are realizing that toys, possessions, basically, are not just taken away. And if you borrow something, then you take it back. Another way to do this as well is that if the opportunity comes or if the circumstance is permitted, then the child borrows or asks to borrow a friend's toy. Allow it to borrow. Basically.
Uh-huh.
Don't play the game that, oh, you didn't allow, so then it's not fair that she allows it to you. No. Actually, take the opportunity to let her borrow a toy, basically.
Yeah.
And when they take the toy back home, the next day, say, now we have to return back the toy to them because it's not ours. It's
uh-huh.
For
it's
example, Zahra's. It's their toy, basically.
Yeah.
So the child slowly then actually realizes that what happens is that things that are not mine, we can return them back to the other people. And so she plays it then back to herself. Then that means that if I borrow a toy to my friend, then it'll get back to me as well.
So thank you so much, Brother Mehdad. And your listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Ya Muqiyal Khayran, Ya Muqiyal Khayran.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about children being possessive with their toys. So Brother Mehdad, please continue.
Right, so we said that through experience and through going to other people's houses and playing with their toys and also sometimes borrowing people's toys and other friends' toys and then returning them back to them without them being broken, obviously, yeah. It's actually part of the journey through which, through experience, the child actually slowly begins to realize that sharing is actually not a bad thing. My possession is never under question. It's still my toy. I will always get back. I will always get it back, basically.
Yeah.
And I can feel safe about this. So the key point is about this feeling of safety and security within them regarding their
possession. We need to teach them sharing, like how to share their stuff.
By giving them, by quenching their thirst for this feeling of safety in relation to their possession. One of the things that I like to encourage as well is sometimes when it's exaggerated, this could lead as well to an attachment to one's toys. Children feel really attached to their possession. Parents need to be able to control the situation that doesn't become in an exaggerated way. Obviously, it's again, it's a phase that will pass on. However, we need to monitor that it doesn't become like a child feels really, really attached to their toys in a way that they can't separate from that toy. We need to avoid those kind of situations. And this sometimes comes through giving them this feeling of security and safety regarding their toys. But also, in terms of parents themselves, the way they react with their toys, the way they react with their own possessions as well, right? You know, sometimes parents have a mobile phone or a laptop, for example, or something that they're very particular about. And they show a similar reaction to that towards their parents. I never allow my child to touch their phone. Even my wife can't touch my phone. Nobody touches my phone. It's very precious. I always have it with me. I take care of it. And child observes this, right? They see my dad always acting in a way with their phone. And so they build the same thing with their own toy as well. So they pick up a teddy bear or a car, for example. This becomes my thing that nobody else is allowed to touch. So they're actually reciprocating a thing that they've seen from their parents. So it's up to parents to be very careful that they shouldn't show themselves attachment to something that they have in a way that children then actually are just role modeling. So we have to be careful to, when we're dealing with our own stuff, as well as the stuff that they have, when we deal with the toys that the children have, for example, we shouldn't be so particular about the toys never breaking, the toys always being in their place, toys never being misplaced. No, it's okay. Children break their toys. Children misplace their toys. It's very, very normal and very natural. And we should be very flexible about these things. When you show this flexibility, what happens is a child becomes not too attached to the toys. Life goes on if my toy breaks, basically. Why? Because I've seen my parents as well. They don't really mind sometimes my toys break. It's okay. You don't have to be on the other side as well. Completely careless about things. No, but it's not the end of the world when a toy breaks. And the child needs to learn that I can't be so attached to my toys. And when they learn this, you see child able to grow now because they're not so attached to something that's mundane, something like a toy. That's another point. And lastly, if we have time, regarding sharing within the house, regarding sharing within between siblings, one small tip I'd like to give is to try and avoid making too much mine and yours in the house. Avoid making very strong distinctions about toys, that this particular toy belongs to this child and that particular toy belongs to that child, right? Sometimes toys can belong to the home, right? Bring the possession back to home or back to the family, basically. This belongs to the family. It's not mine and yours, that this is mine and this is yours. And we have to draw lines over here. You play with my toy, I have to play with your toy. You create a homely environment, saying these are home toys, they're family toys, basically. And slowly, so what happens is that there's this lack of attachment to these toys because they belong to the family. And you don't feel this very strong emotional of possession about these things. And this actually helps you then be able to share a bit more and be more flexible when it comes to things.
Thank you so much, Brother Meghdad. That was really a good explanation. And thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you for staying with us. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Until the end of the program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
European News Bulletin.
My name is Saeed Puruza. Our top story, we begin in the Swedish capital, Stockholm, where Nobel Prizes have been awarded for achievements in various fields over the course of the year. While the ceremony brought some much-needed cheer in a year riddled with so much difficulty, concerns surrounding next year's humanitarian challenges are never too far away. Mortaza Jaffer starts us off.
So many times before,
as the year comes to a close, so too does the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony. Only this time history was made with the committee in Sweden while the laureates appeared on screen socially distant across the globe. Awards were handed for numerous categories, but the feature standout remains the Peace Prize. In this pandemic year, with economies reeling and record numbers of refugees fleeing war, famine and disease, the UN World Food Programme were awarded the prize for their efforts tackling hunger across the globe.
Wow. Waking up this morning in this beautiful city here in Rome, it's hard to imagine that in about 400 AD, this city experienced a massive famine. It ended up killing almost 90% of its population. It's hard to imagine us going through a famine like that. But my tragic duty today is to tell you, famine is at humanity's doorstep for millions and millions of people on Earth. Because of so many wars, climate change, the widespread use of hunger as a political and military weapon, and a global health pandemic that makes all of that exponentially worse, 270 million people are marching towards starvation. Failure to address their needs will cause a hunger pandemic which will dwarf the impact of COVID.
270 million people is equivalent to the combined populations of the UK, Germany, France, and Italy, all at the brink of starvation. What's more, the coronavirus pandemic has sharply escalated the severity of the crisis. As senior UN officials convened at the General Assembly, the message was clear. 2021 is shaping up to be an even greater humanitarian catastrophe as global coronavirus cases continue to accelerate. With vaccines offering a way out, the fear remains that poorer nations will be left behind.
We simply cannot accept a world in which the poor and marginalized are trampled by the rich and powerful in the stampede for vaccines. This is a global crisis, and the solutions must be shared equitably as global public goods, not as private commodities that widen inequalities and become yet another reason some people are left behind.
According to the UN, global measures to tackle the virus have fueled a 40% increase in the number of people relying on humanitarian help and have appealed once again for wealthier nations to assist developing countries struggling to cope. Vaccines are currently being administered in the UK, Canada, and Russia, with various Western nations soon to begin the rollout. However, the nature of the pandemic is such, failing to tackle the problem globally will only mean the threat of another wave that will only delay a return back to normal.
A pandemic that will dwarf the impact of the coronavirus pandemic. Much of the Jaffer there. Speaking of the coronavirus pandemic, it has affected everyone's life one way or another, but it's dealt a heavier blow to some more than others. Food charities in the UK are referring to them as the newly hungry, a growing cohort of people previously in good jobs and enjoying decent incomes. The hardest hit among them, families with children.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. the numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a 0 hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food banks. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her 3-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warned these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pourreza, London.
UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that there is now a strong possibility that Britain will crash out of the EU without a trade deal at the end of the year. He said British firms should carefully prepare for what's to come after December 31st. Wading into the squabble, EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen spoke of the key issues between the two sides earlier today.
Positions remain apart on fundamental issues. On the level playing field, we have repeatedly made clear to our UK partners that the principle of fair competition is a precondition to privileged access to the EU market. It is the largest single market in the world, and it is only fair that competitors to our own enterprises face the same conditions on our own market.
The two sides have said this Sunday as the deadline for an agreement and said they didn't believe talks would continue beyond that. The Netherlands-based UN Special Tribunal for Lebanon has sentenced a member of the Hezbollah resistance movement to life for alleged involvement in the 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. The sentencing comes months after a hearing convicted Salim Ayash in absentia of being involved in the suicide truck bombing on Beirut's seafront that killed Hariri and 21 others. The investigation has been criticized for its lack of evidence linking Ayash to the bombing. Hezbollah have repeatedly denied any involvement. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, has defended the government's controversial new anti-radicalization law, saying that accusations of Islamophobia against the bill are largely misrepresented. France has faced a fierce backlash from Muslim leaders across the world after it presented legislation it says will clamp down on, quote, radical Islam. New measures to be imposed will include tightening rules on religious-based education and registering mosques as places of worship. France has been accused of being Islamophobic after President Emmanuel Macron defended blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and described Islam as being in crisis. The European Union has extended sanctions against Russia by another 6 months. European Council President Charles Michel announced that EU leaders had agreed to impose a wave of new sanctions targeting the Russian economy, including the oil sector. The new measures will continue until the end of July next year. The move comes days after the U.S. imposed further bans on several Russian individuals and entities. Moscow's ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Antonov, has warned the move will further deepen the crisis in relations between the two world powers.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
After the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan, Morocco has become the fourth Arab country to strike a deal to establish full diplomatic relations with, guess whom? Israel. Another gift to Benjamin Netanyahu from the outgoing Trump administration in the U.S., condemned by Palestinians, Iran, and all those loyal to the Palestinian struggle. Robert Inukesh has been keeping his ear to the ground and joins me now with more details on that story. Robert, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Saeed. And this move has been described as another stab in the back of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause by the Arab regimes, and of course makes it harder for the Arab Peace Initiative to work if it was a so-called two-state solution that they were aiming for the international community. And we see little condemnation from the international community of these moves as of recently. But before we go further into this story, let's play a clip of Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli premier himself, announcing this. And he's very happy with himself. So check it out.
I've always believed that this historic day would come. I've always worked for it. I want to first thank President Trump for his extraordinary efforts to expand peace, to bring peace to Israel and the peoples of the Middle East.
He says he knew this day would come, Robert.
Well, this has been in the planning for some time now, and of course Donald Trump is doing all he can whilst he is in office to put Netanyahu in a favorable position to his own population. But less on that and more on the fact that he said peace in the region, which is quite a funny thing because the Western Sahara now, the occupied Western Sahara, has just been declared by the U.S. Trump administration to belong to Morocco, and that would mean essentially that the hundreds of thousands of refugees, Sahrawi refugees, which are currently living in Algeria, would essentially be remain as refugees for the foreseeable future.
About that, what does a recognition by a U.S. administration of a country's sovereignty over a region, in this case Moroccan sovereignty over West Sahara, mean?
Well, of course, it doesn't have international recognition. The Western Sahara as a independent nation has backing by the international community to say that it should be an independent state and should be a UN member. However, we have seen that the Polisario Front, which is the national liberation movement for Western Sahara, has not been ever granted that ability to come to a vote. And at this moment right now, we've seen just, and it's not a coincidence that just in the past months, the ceasefire, the 30-year-long ceasefire which held, has broken down. And guess who's involved in that? The United Arab Emirates, who have just placed their consulate over in Western Sahara on behalf of the Moroccans. The Morocco as well, we have to understand, trying to get closer to the U.S. Trump administration and being pressured on the issue, in 2017 abandoned ties with Iran. And now we see this after the United Arab Emirates have made such a push and had been backing Morocco on the issue so hard. And even there's allegations that UAE fighter jets were used to bombard positions in the Western Sahara. So this is something that has been in the making for some time. And when Netanyahu Netanyahu talks about peace, what peace has come out of this?
That's a very good point, Robert, isn't it? Basically, what they're saying is, you want F-35s, you got to have Benjamin Netanyahu's number. You want 14,000 bombs, in the case of the UAE buying those bombs from the Americans, call Netanyahu, because they have clout, the Israeli lobby, whatever, they have clout in the American administration, and they can really deliver the goods.
Absolutely. And the UAE, when it comes to building bridges for other so-called peace deals to be put on the table, is the perfect asset to have in the Middle East. Its intelligence agency operates. It has a vast intelligence apparatus. And we even saw in the case of Sudan normalization, that was largely due to UAE influence in Sudan, which many people don't really hear about, and many people don't even understand. And when it comes to Morocco, yet again, we see UAE fingerprints there, because the UAE is working on behalf of Israel. And of course, this deal for the UAE has meant opening up of more trade relationships for the United Arab Emirates and weapons, like you said.
All right, take us online and some online reaction.
The first one we have here says, and this is from an Israeli user, they say, diplomatic ties with Israel gets the UAE stealth jets, Morocco, Western Sahara, Sudan sanctions relief, and then Bahrain Chabad House. Bit of a stab there, and then we've got a reply to this from a user called Mo, who says, Sudan hasn't gotten anything tangible. The US uses a stick and the image of a carrot approach with the government of Sudan. Basically a blackmail policy that mostly the Sudanese people pay for rather than the government, typically a US foreign policy. We have another one commenting on this issue here as well, a user called Haril, who says, UN stance on Western Sahara remains unchanged. The UN spokesperson ruins Morocco's colonial regime, rejoicing over usual anarchic personal proclamations of real Donald Trump. That's his Twitter handle, legally gifting it what he does not possess, the occupied Western Sahara.
And this whole thing, Robert, what it does is really calls into question the relevance of the United Nations, because no one seems to be listening to the UN. You said something earlier about the UAE working on behalf of Israel. But what can also be said about this whole thing is the American administration, the Trump administration, over the past 4 years, using its influence around the world to benefit Israel, or from an Israeli standpoint, Benjamin Netanyahu and his band of Likud party members using American influence to their own benefit.
Absolutely. And we have a piece now on that and what Donald Trump has delivered for Israel during his time in office. And of course, this is ongoing, as we've seen with this story on Morocco. So more on that now.
As Donald Trump nears the end of his time as president of the United States, he continues to tighten U.S. support for Israel. But what exactly has Trump done in office that has made him the most pro-Israel president in U.S. history? Let's take a look at what Trump's pro-Israel record looks like. Whilst in office, Trump notably recognized Israel's undivided capital as being Jerusalem al-Quds in December of 2017, later moving the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv in May of 2018. Donald J. Trump then also unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA, at the behest of Netanyahu and the Israel lobby in the United States. As president, he also saw it fit to kick out the PLO from their office in Washington, D.C. This is prior to him structuring a so-called peace deal, which was supposed to, in the words of Trump, favor both the Israelis and Palestinians. In June of 2018, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley announced that the U.S. was withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council, citing biased criticism of Israel being one of the principal reasons for the U.S. doing so. Whilst the embassy move was ongoing, a massacre was committed of Palestinian peaceful protesters in Gaza, as Israeli snipers targeted and murdered over 60 unarmed demonstrators, including journalists and medics. Trump's administration sat by throughout the entire course of what was to be named the Great Return March in Gaza, constituting one of the largest, by percentage of the besieged Gazan population, non-violent protest movements in history. The Trump administration defended Israel repeatedly, claiming that Israel was under attack and defended itself. This is despite a UNHRC report, as well as countless human rights group reports, categorically debunking this as a lie. The silence on the part of the U.S. Trump administration amounted to Israel murdering at least 330 unarmed demonstrators, injuring 35,000. No Israelis were significantly injured or killed. The United States not only cheered on Israel as it massacred the people of the Gaza Strip, but went a step further. In August of 2018, Trump withdrew all funding from UNRWA, or the UN agency set up to help Palestinian refugees. Gaza's population is a 70-plus percent population of refugees. In 2019, Trump signed an order recognizing the illegally occupied Golan Heights as being Israeli territory, contrary to international law, which stipulates that the land belongs to Syria. Donald Trump's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo also announced that it is not per se inconsistent with international law in regard to the U.S.'s position on Israel's illegal occupation of the West Bank, and that settlements were not illegal. In February of 2019, Trump also decided to cut funds altogether of any kind from going to Palestinians in the occupied territories. This meant a full defunding of the Palestinian Authority based in Ramallah, this coming right before the economic side of Trump's infamous deal of the century, which was to be announced. Whilst the U.S. president was cutting funding from Palestinian programs, the $3.8 billion in foreign assistance for Israel was left completely untouched, as Trump approved at least $500 million in assistance for Israeli air defense weaponry. And who could forget the so-called deal of the century, revealed in February of 2020, which essentially condemned Palestinians to living in South African apartheid-style Bantustans, with no state at all to speak of. Trump did not stop, however, continuing on his quest to be the biggest gift to Netanyahu that keeps on giving. The U.S. president left a window open for Israel to deliver the campaign promise of Netanyahu, going ahead with a de jure annexation of the West Bank. When Benjamin Netanyahu realized that this was a move which would cost him too greatly, understanding that the West Bank has already been annexed in reality, Netanyahu then needed a way out. But luckily, Netanyahu's savior, Trump, came to the rescue and put normalization deals on the table with the UAE, Bahrain, and later Sudan, which gave the perfect distraction Israel needed. With Trump almost reaching election day, the gifts didn't stop coming. The Trump administration in late October signed a deal with Israel extending its scientific cooperation deals with Israel into the West Bank and Golan Heights, making the U.S. complicit in war crimes. Then a few days later, Trump signed off in a symbolic middle finger to the Palestinians and to the international community by allowing U.S. citizens born in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, to have their place of birth on their passports altered to say Israel. Since the mainstream media announcement that Joe Biden is the USA's president-elect, the Trump-Netanyahu alliance has not fallen apart. In fact, since Netanyahu congratulated Joe Biden on his win, the Trump administration has seemingly made it a priority to make sure Israel is in the best position possible to destroy any prospects of a two-state solution talk going ahead under Joe Biden. Israel immediately began upping its illegal home demolition campaign in East Jerusalem al-Quds, which has this year broken all previous records for the number of Palestinian homes demolished in the occupied territory. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu then announced plans for the establishment of a new settlement adjacent to the besieged Gaza Strip, whilst Israel's Minister of War, Benny Gantz, announced 1,700 additional settler units would be built in the West Bank. Israel's Jerusalem al-Quds municipality then announced and approved the construction of 100-plus settler units inside of Ramat Shlomo settlement, which was supposed to be a red line for the international community due to the fact that it helps encircle East Jerusalem al-Quds with settlements and cuts it off from the West Bank. Then it was announced that Israel was going to build up its settlement known as Givat Hamatos, which would effectively isolate East Jerusalem al-Quds from Bethlehem. On top of this, during Mike Pompeo's most recent visit to Israel, Netanyahu reportedly requested permission to expand the Atarot settlement in East Jerusalem al-Quds, which could cut off the area from the West Bank city of Ramallah. This year alone, almost 1,000 Palestinians have been made homeless from illegal Israeli home demolitions, whilst Palestinians are being expelled from their homes. Israel is simultaneously expanding illegal settlements in strategic areas, which would further cut off Palestinian cities and towns from each other in the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. To rub salt in the wounds of the Palestinian people, the Trump administration's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, just visited illegal settlements in the West Bank and Golan Heights. Pompeo endorsed a winery in an illegal settlement and declared that not only were settlement products to be labeled as products of Israel proper, but that the U.S. was declaring that the BDS movement was anti-Semitic and coming after those supporting it as if they were members of the KKK. New settlement expansionist plans are being released every week now, with no meaningful international pushback and endorsements from the U.S. Trump administration, along with the new home demolition orders. Israel and the U.S. are working together to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian native population.